bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Adrian Main, joined by Mr. Brian Brushwood.
Hello, beautiful people.
Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody. That's me.
Gentlemen, it's good to be back.
Welcome back, Andrew.
I don't know why you would say that. I mean, I understand you got busy with your political podcast, but I mean, you've always been here.
True that. He was in
Iowa messing with some machines.
Wherever politics are decided, and it's all decided now.
I don't know if you were around when when I was pitching this, but I was begging Justin. He had a quick gig in Idaho before he went to Iowa, and I wanted him to run around with a camera and say, "Hi, I'm a journalist. I have a politics podcast. Can I just ask you some questions about politics?" And then increasingly through the questions, make it clear that he's confused and he thinks that
he's in Iowa, not Idaho.
And then let people figure it out. That would be an amazing viral video.
There is this amazing human capacity, though, of how we'll start talking with somebody and maybe not get context. And we're just talking about this before the show about how we're using transcription now that we'll go back and correct it. Because then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I get what you mean now. And so sometimes we'll go a long ways talking to somebody, trying to get the context of it. And then you're like, and then you might go, oh, I have no idea what we're talking about.
Or there's that moment that you realize, oh, wait, they think I'm somebody else. They think I'm this other person.
Yep. They think I'm somebody who knows things.
The name of the show isn't Knows Things.
Yeah, we don't. So, have we talked about Wuhan? Have we talked about the?
Oh my God! For a split second, novel? I thought you were about to say, "Have we talked about Elon Musk?"
No. I don't even notice my shirt, by the way.
What is that? It looks like an.
Oh, that's the shatter from the Cybertruck.
Oh my God!
Oh, that's great. I thought it was like that should be the.
I look like a comet
to his trance album.
Official Tesla merchandise.
That's great.
Yes.
Oh, that's great.
We knew when that happened, we're back in, just for those of you who don't know, back when they unveiled the Cybertruck, the not at all controversial vehicle from Tesla, Elon Musk went to display the shatterproof window. And prior to displaying the shatterproof window, they took a sledgehammer to the side of this Tesla truck, which was impressive. And then they took a big metal ball and hit the window and it shattered and realized a property of glass that once you get a microfracture, it doesn't matter how strong it is, gonna crack. And so it cracked right on there, and you could see a visibly frustrated Elon Musk. But it's a Musk, you're like, you know what, he's gonna laugh about this tomorrow. And then sure enough, here in the Tesla merchandise store, we now have the Cybertruck shattered window.
So speaking of which, and here's a rare moment when it's Brian that insists we go into Elon things. Being here in Texas, I don't know if you heard the rumblings. You know, Elon Musk changed his location to Austin, Texas. There was talk about a gigafactory, you know, to generate batteries here in Texas. And the analysis was basically that would fix, first of all, pickup trucks tend to be a very specific demographically targeted market. And they labeled it the cowboy problem, is if you are somebody who actually has a ranch and actually is doing all this stuff, then you want the reliability of your Ford F-150. People who are into pickup trucks get really geeked out about, you know, who has the most torque, the fastest, you know, acceleration, efficiency, blah, 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 blah. But with a reputation of being a Silicon Valley startup, that's problematic for Tesla to try to break into that market, especially with what some might consider a fairly over the top, ridiculous cyberpunk design of a truck. But if it's born and bred in Texas, manufactured locally by American workers, then that might quote unquote solve the cowboy problem was what the news article said.
My thinking on it is, you know, they're in Nevada is where they have a big facility right now. The Gigafactory 2 is at. Certainly in the Texas environment, the idea that it's made in state could probably help. I think the F-150 is like it to transport for like kind of an industrial or kind of transportation. It's almost like the container, like the international. It is such a staple, such an important thing, not just because of the brand name, but because of the reliability, the parts, the idea of just there's so much more to it than, you know, I think a lot of people from the outside who didn't grow up around trucks or whatever may even appreciate, you know.
Sure. Well, whether you're hauling farm equipment or industrial equipment or whatever, there comes this moment when, sure, I wouldn't mind flying a UFO, but I know that at the end of the day, I have to know that replacement parts are always available. I have to know that it has a certain level of reliability. I know that my insurance company has to be not confused about how to set rates for X, Y, and Z.
I have to be able to fuel it.
Right. Oh, exactly. Yep. Yep. Right. Although, am I right? The Cybertruck can go up to like 500 miles. Is that what they're talking about?
Yeah, it's going to be something insane. I think that's going to be a slow adoption, but all those points you made are super, super critical. And I think that's one of the things we think about in any system, like, oh, why don't we do X? Why don't we do X? And it's like, you know, there's the, what was the expression from Alchemy talked about when you come across like a fence across a road before you pull away the fence, ask why it's there. And you have to understand why something works so well, why we're so dependent upon it. And it's like when we have this, like, I'm wearing a Tesla shirt, but when I hear people like, ah, let's get rid of fossil fuels, I'm like, I don't think you know what that means. You know, yeah. I don't think you know. Like, I'm all for the eventual sort of thing, but like, well, let's ban gas next week.
It's really a matter of risk tolerance, and I think there's if you're running a business, if you're running a family, once you have something to lose, a lot of people discover they have less appetite for risk than one might think, no matter how cool the flashy other thing is. You know, like the DeLorean looks very, very cool. Also looks an awful lot like a Cybertruck. But its lack of availability of parts, the fact that the guy didn't really know how to design an automobile from the ground up or whatever, there's a reason that it was a failure. And so I don't blame anybody who has something to lose for playing it safe when it comes to picking what truck they're going for.
Yeah, it was like related was like, and again, I'm very pro shifting to electric solar. Let me make it very, very clear. But there was a story that came out like a week or so ago about, I guess at Oxford, some students had pushed for administration to divest from investing in oil and all that. Like, we shouldn't be in oil stocks, blah, 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 blah. And we should get away from oil entirely. And the administrator was like, hey, great. Why don't we shut off heating? How about that? Because we have to use oil to heat the place. Are you okay if we just shut that off now? And they're like, oh, no, no, no.
Yeah.
Wait, let's not do that.
So,
but it's more nuanced than that. But yeah.
Back to Wuhan. Are we about to talk about a Michael Crichton novel in the making?
Yeah. So let's put a caveat first here. We don't know what the heck we're talking about, and ... Neither do a lot of people on the internet, or even a lot of bloggers and stuff, know what they're talking about, because we don't know a lot about it. We're trying to figure this thing out as it goes along, and this isn't meant to be like, run for the hills, everybody. Nor is it supposed to be like, it's nothing. You know, it's 50 million people in quarantine. They're having fun. And, you know, it's we don't know. And I guess, yeah, it is exactly what you just said, Brian. You know, you watch the little map and you watch the thing spread and you look at, like, you know, I was sitting at Denny's talking to my girlfriend behind her. The TV shows, like, you know, the military quarantining someplace somewhere and people in masks and stuff. I'm like, this is how a horror movie starts, is we're just going about our business and the things going on in the background.
Mm-hmm. We definitely and fingers crossed, it won't. History will not judge me poorly for my flippant hot take, but as coronavirus first started to make the news, I found it rather curious that there were two simultaneous statements from the Chinese government. One, that only 2,000 people were infected. The second being, we're going to build a hospital that can handle tens of thousands of people in 10 days. You know, and I was like, those two don't seem to match. And so,
and we will just so every the technical name and the only reason I'm clarifying this now because there is confusion. We'll say coronavirus, but it's 2019. In COV, you know, because coronavirus includes like SARS and MERS and other stuff. There's a
coronavirus
lot
is any virus that is on the corona, the fringes. It's a derivation. It's a new mutation.
Yeah.
It's so a dance it sensation. Let's do the time warp again. That's what I'm trying to say.
So I'll give you an example of like my shaking my head was I read an article and I don't want to say it was basically like from a fashion or, you know, like a beauty blogger person on a previously pretty famous website that now, you know, blah, blah, blah. But anyhow, and they're like, hey, worry about the flu, not this. And I'm like, well, maybe worry about both. When I saw the headline, I'm like, flu, we know, this we do not know. And so to say, don't worry about a thing that all of our information, as Brian just pointed out, is being controlled by a government notorious for controlling things, even to the point of people dying. I have a friend who swears their grandfather died from SARS before it had been announced, but China had kept, you know, a lid on that. So maybe, but anyhow, and they go into like one in that article that's supposed to be informative. They talk to a doctor who is not directly involved in this. But, you know, they get some, you know, and he's like, people need to worry about flu, which is yes, true. Worry about flu, but they never use the correct name for it. They never mention, you know, the 2019 NCOV, right? So they never mention that name, which is one. If you just do a search, you're only going to find coronavirus. They use the Wuhan coronavirus, which is not a official name. Then they go in there and they say, hey, right now they say, you know, so far only 28,000 people are infected and 520 people have died. Okay. And then they link to the Johns Hopkins map. 3 hours after they'd posted the article, if you go to the Johns Hopkins map, the number of infected jumped by like 4,000 or 5,000 people, and the number of dead had jumped by like 80 people, which was just had to do with the update at which this map had been done and when they wrote the article. But if you go by the article, like, don't panic. Well, then you click there to read there, you'd be like, oh my God! In the last 3 hours, there's been like a 30% increase in infections and death rate. You'd be like, no, I guess we do panic now. And it's just that example of very bad. Yeah. Since this article was published, you know, a week ago, like the number of deaths almost doubled, you know, and granted, I don't know what to make of that, but I know that somebody writing an article saying don't panic, who then uses very panicking information unintentionally, not ideal.
There was an article by Ron Bailey, and I think it was published on Reason.com, or maybe it was elsewhere, and then they reprinted it on Reason.com, but he, and again, man, oh man, do human beings love the narrative of an out of control virus that kills everybody. Yeah. We love being scared about it. We love watching the numbers climb. There is an inherent bias in news coverage for if I was an editor in chief, then it seems like there's more dollars in spreading fear than not. But Ron Bailey sort of made the case, and again, bold take, that look, information spreads faster than viruses can physically make it, and our ability to contain things and to change policies and to quarantine happens faster than the virus is capable of spreading. And he suggests, I think fairly lightly, I don't think he makes a hard case for it, but he suggests that maybe humanity has seen its last pandemic, assuming that we don't have some kind of massive backslide in cooperation between humans who want to stop pandemics. And so he suggests that yes, this will be another exciting event to watch, but even though it does appear to be more deadly than SARS, it does appear to be spreading faster than SARS or whatever, his general case seemed to be, if I was a betting person, and I am, then I'd bet on humanity.
There won't be another virus,
more pandemics,
or another
not of the level of your Spanish flus from the 19 or early 20th centuries or any of those numbers. Like, just seeing, it's basically, it seems like he was making a testament to when you compare side by side what 100 years ago the spread of a pandemic looked like versus the massive action and the speed with which impactful actions are taken, that it seems fairly unlikely that anything will spread as big or as fast as we saw 100 years ago.
Well, I have the article in front of me, and disclosure, I'm friends with Ron, and I want to get Ron's latest take on this because he doesn't mention Spanish flu. He mentions avian flu as the example in 2003.
Right, correct.
And I think that the theory is right. The problem is when it's a state actor like China, which has a vested interest in not letting information spread, we've already passed avian flu death rate. We've already passed that. And so this is a pandemic. That's the thing. It's like, this is technically a pandemic in the rate of spread. And I think the problem is that because there was a lockdown, like the doctor who one of the first people to discover this and explain, hey, tell his friends, hey, something's going on, was punished. The other people were punished. That guy has since passed away from Wuhan, which is scary when, you know, one of the first medical personnel to explain this. So I think that had the Chinese government learned the lesson and behaved in a, you know, more open way, probably Ron would be right.
Well, but and I think I believe, and man, I wish I had known we were going to talk about this because I would have reviewed the article, but I think he mentioned the astonishing speed at which we had fully sequenced the genome of it. Viruses, do they have DNA? Yeah, no, yeah. They inject DNA.
What's that?
Do viruses have DNA or do they inject DNA?
Generally RNA. They're RNA, but then at which you can sequence the RNA. But yeah, and that's all true. That is 100% right on the state of the tech. But remember, when he wrote this, as it says there, if you go down, 41 people had been infected.
Sure. Yeah. And again, like I'm not gonna say everybody please spit on your hands and shake hands and then lick your hands. I mean, like I think.
What if we were already doing that? Can I keep doing?
And I think it would be far worse without those. I think the technical points are right. I think without those measures, it could have been far worse. It could have spread far faster. I think the technology has evolved considerably in the last two decades. Since we dealt with the avian flu and SARS and MERS, even, you know, and the problem is that I think what's going to happen after the fact is we're going to be, what should we have known before? And I mentioned, like with the case of SARS, is what China held back on information on that, and it had spread to other countries when China knew what was going on. And here, you know, the frustrating thing is that the way China sort of works, not that noted Chinese expert Andrew Main, every region has, like, you have regional governors and then you have smaller regions. Everybody's sort of, the information suppression starts at sort of the lowest level. It starts at your company or it starts at your organization, and they try to suppress whatever they think won't displease the people above them. And likewise, all the way up to the top of the party and then to the leader of the party.
Sure. And by the way, imagine a little footnote, and then at the bottom of the page, it says, see HBO's Chernobyl, you know, for more details. Yep.
Slightly more efficient, but basically, yeah, you know, and that's the thing is you get all the way up. I don't want the people above me to get upset or else I'm going to be pulled from my position or my job. I don't want the people above me. And, you know, some doctors say, oh, no, we think there's something thing. Nobody wants that. And generally speaking, they're wrong. It isn't the thing they think it is. It's, you know, they're afraid it is because the chances of that happening. And so you get all that layer of suppression all the way up. And meanwhile, people are spreading. That was one of the things, the scary things about Wuhan was the number of people that left the area before the quarantine came.
We talked either last week or the week before about a company that was using AI or machine learning to try to track possible Wuhan coronavirus cases and get the government and the global health community to recognize sort of the early warning signs of this. But even still, it seems like a pretty devastating disease. And I think about, like, I mean, we talked about the flu earlier, but like every year we are trying to figure out, we're just guessing what the flu is going to be every year. And
right.
sometimes we're close and sometimes we're not. And so if that's something we're dealing with every year, like I think we will continue to find very difficult to handle viruses.
So I had a random and yet it turns out connected thought right before we went live with the show, we were talking about the fact that we're using an AI bot to auto-transcribe everything that we're saying right now so that we can have closed captioning and all that. And I remember wondering, right now, if you want to set the subject of what we're talking about in Twitch, you have to make the decision of like, oh, we're talking about trans rights. We're talking about Fortnite. We're talking about the Lego movie or whatever. Oh. It seems like once everything we're saying is being auto-translated, then an AI could very quickly figure out, much like depending on what vehicle you're behind, based on three bumper stickers, you could have a pretty good assumption of where somebody is on the political spectrum from certain uses of language. I would assume that an AI would be able to figure out where, likewise, not only what we're talking about, but imagine if just by monitoring all of social media, and in fact, as I'm saying this, I'm assuming it has to already exist in some form, that you could look for keywords that are synonyms or indicative of certain symptoms, and you can intuit basically by listening to everybody all at the same time, you can real time sense the spread of a disease based on what people are saying. At any given time, do you think we'll start to see even faster than the reactions that Ron Bailey's talking about? Do you think we'll get to a place where an AI, like before even a single human recognizes that there's a new coronavirus of whatever virus spreading, the AI could say like, been listening to you guys. There's clearly something new. It's clearly in this area. Yeah, you better hustle up and investigate these people.
I'm sure that we're going to see starting like in places where personal data freedom or our privacy just don't exist in China and stuff, like how you're going to probably want to see one will be first is it's a thing like that, but using like hospital records, you know, thing like that, using, you know, basically trying to measure at that level, like take the humans out of the equation and say like, hey, you know, we had a holiday season this weekend and we had twice as many show up in the emergency room on a Monday than we did before. And there are things like that right now that like all the kind of health agencies sort of monitor to a degree, but I don't know. I don't think it's anywhere as sophisticated as we think it could be. And then, you know, to the social media stuff like that, things like that, like, yeah, there's a ton of information out there. Like, you know, who's sick, tracking, who's not moving, who didn't leave their house today because they're feeling ill and stuff. And, you know, the danger of anything, of course, is like, you know, separating when, you know, everybody goes and watches the movie Contagion. The next day we all feel like, oh, I don't know if I feel well. Do you feel well? I don't know. I don't feel well. And it's like, ah, there's a virus. But
yeah, and that. Like what you're describing, the issue, I think, for today would be horsepower. Just, I mean, that's not big data. That's all data. All data being looked at in broad by a computer for one purpose.
Oh, we got an offer from some Chinese investors, Brian, to buy your company.
No, I don't even think you need all data. I think just a statistically significant sample size. You know, take 100,000 accounts and analyze their posting track record. When do they stop posting? When a week later do they come back and talk about how they were sick or whatever? Then all of a sudden, like the mere fact that somebody's not posting becomes a data vector. And then you locate that to what, like what area they're in and that kind of stuff.
Who else stopped posting detecting near them?
Exactly. You know? Exactly. And who you know they met based on the geotags from the photos that they're doing or whatever. Like it doesn't have to be all data. We don't have to make up a fantasy scenario. I think as long as it's statistically significant, you're able to get a jump on it.
Yeah, if you build a profile of like what does a person do when they get sick, like, you know, of what that, how does that map up to that? And I'm sure we're going to see that. You know, the other thing too is like the more we develop, you know, on chip detectors, the more we develop the ability to sequence this stuff and figure this thing out in real time, it'd be great. Because like I spent some time on Twitter saying, hey, like I was going like, hey, like, listen, there's a lot of like misleading information out there, you know, that some of it's good intention, but some of it's like, oh, don't panic, but not well, well intentioned, but not well informed. And some of it's like, ah, it's a plan, it's a conspiracy. And it's, someone's like, hey, listen, like follow the CDC emergency Twitter tag, follow the AdWho Twitter tag, use common sense and wash your damn hands, you know? And that's my thing was like, I did a thing, like I said, like, I think it's socially acceptable now. if you see somebody who doesn't wash their hands in a bathroom, to follow them out with a bell and keep ringing it and shame them. Most everybody said, yeah. And then I had one person who said, oh, I don't wash my hands. And I'm like, well, you're a sociopath, you know, like, what's the story on this? And she said, well, I have like OCD about washing my hands, and to the point that like I was having, I'm like, okay, well, that's a different thing where you've got some psychological thing that you're dealing with, which I can't even fathom. But like for the rest of us, like I remember when we worked at a casino, I remember watching people going in and out who highest percentage of people I've ever seen that don't wash their hands. It's in a casino. And other
well,
people
luckily it's not like all of their hands are going to go touch a bunch of communal objects that are then going to be shuffled together and then passed around to other people,
let alone paper money.
Yeah.
Just the most.
Yeah. It's scary. And I also think that, like, you know, how many times you've been at a restaurant or whatever, and you see somebody behind the cash register who is wiping their nose or coughing in their hand or whatever, and this stuff. And then you're like, and that's how it spreads. I mean, I mean, we've all, not to say, oh, it's those fast food employees, but I'm saying is people who come in contact with a lot of other people or their food, that's because it's not just it's in the food, but it's in the wrappers, it's in the containers. This is how these things spread. This is very much how these things spread. And one of the things too is like we feel safer sometimes going to the drive-thru, but often what they do is they put the sickest person in the back so you can't see them. I think that we need to think about, like, one is workplaces are hesitant to send people home or whatever, or pay them but send them home because you don't want to be abused because I'm sick, I think I got it, okay, go home, great, I'm short, people. But we need to think about systems for that, to like, one, how do you know somebody's sick? I love the idea of like eventually coming up with some sort of test that's like, hey, yeah, take this test this before you go show up on the shift today, and if you have the flu, we'll pay to go home because we don't want to get sick, because also the idea of liability, which I think a lot of places would want to avoid using it because of that. But I think about the future of that, of how do we just, if you're sick, how do we avoid contaminating other people?
Yeah. And I think there could be a world where let's say a third body, similar to Underwriters Laboratories, that tests all of the electronics. You can't sell anything at Walmart, Target, or any other major supplier that's an electronic item that isn't tested by Underwriters Laboratory. So imagine somebody does that, saying, hey, we've come up with a very simple, it's unfortunate that this is the example, but Gattaca style test, where everybody who comes in once a week, you hit a thing and then it just runs screens for all current flu or whatever. And it's just, there's a little, let's say a red check mark. That means everyone who's working here today has been tested. And on an ongoing basis, you can rely on us. And then all of a sudden there becomes a financial incentive where it's like, well, hey, if you're going to get hamburgers somewhere, make sure it's someplace that's tested. And then all of a sudden it becomes weird if you're not tested. And along with running, similar to that UL logo, all of a sudden it becomes too scary to not get on the program and make sure that all of the human workers involved are not testing for illness every day.
Man, I would not like to have a daily record of my entire health owned by my employer or a third party company, though.
Yeah, I mean, you could work in some sort of safeguard, because your concern is to say that, like, you don't want somebody who has the latest strain of flu handling people's food, because it will, you know, we lose we lose more people to flu every year than we do to, like, you know, like gun homicide, like the number. And it's one of these things you talk about, like, washing your hands and sanitizing would save thousands of lives. More people did that. The number of people we would save by doing that would be tremendous. And not to mention other infectious things that we don't quite track as well, or, you know, how they, you know, the rate at which they go from person to person. So I could certainly see, like, you know, if I knew a restaurant says, yeah, we do this. And if they said, hey, because, like, you know, restaurants will do this, oh, we're, you know, GMO free, which I'm like, great. You guys don't believe in science. I don't trust you now.
It's you almost know, like a bizarro reverse version of what I'm proposing. It's just like, exactly. We have an awful understanding of what really matters.
Yeah, I've, you know, it's one of those things, like, where, you know, when I've seen, like there's the I think there's probably a correlation to the prouder a restaurant says they're, like, GMO free into their likelihood of having, like,
E. coli.
Exactly. You know, I think there's probably, I can think of one famous example of that. But like, I could see that, could say, hey, listen, and here's our policy. Like, if an employee shows up and they're tested for something like this, we send them home, but we pay them. You know, we take it. We're not going to, because, you know, these are people who are work, you know, it's hard because, like, you know, if you're working minimum wage, you know, and you got the flu and you got, you know, you're working a low paid job rather, and you've got,
ooh,
kids.
This is interesting. Yeah. Then you run into the dead cobra problem in places where I believe it was in India. They had a problem with a lot of cobras, or in other places they had a problem with rats. So what they do is they'd offer a bounty for anyone who shows up with a killed cobra. Guess who starts a cobra farm and mm-hmm. starts making them fat stacks showing up with a bunch of dead cobras. So you don't, you would want
it seems, but you're suggesting that people would intend to get sick.
Oh, I have done. When I didn't want to go to school, I would actively engage. Like, I would hang around sick people. Like, I've faked sickness. Like,
but people who are working hourly or are working lower paid jobs would.
Yes. And I believe any person is capable of doing this, but I mean, the upside
okay.
Let me just get the other part of it.
Because people are going to go to work sick, and people are going to say that they're sick and go to work. Look, I mean,
your girlfriend definitely has the flu. You definitely know you could get paid the same amount by not going into work. You don't mind kissing your girlfriend. That would be a significant incentive to just, and you know that your employer tests for these things and immediately compensates you. So you would want to structure the compensation in such a way where it rewards healthy behavior.
Right. Well, I don't expect that, like, in this fantasy that is all hypothetical, you would just get your entire day's wage, but
certain things you can only get, like, once per strain. And so the idea is you'd figure, like, well, you know, you're going to test for flu. Like, all right, you got it. You infect yourself, whatever. We don't care. You're allowed, you know, you're allowed 7 days or whatever. If you get it, you can have as many dead cobras as you want, but strains of flu, you can only kind of get that thing once.
Yeah. So, and keep in mind, we live in a world where chicken pox parties are an actual thing. And now we live in a horrifying world where measles parties are an actual thing. And that is for the only theoretical benefit of being able to proudly say that you didn't have to vaccinate your child, not the highly tangible benefit of being able to get paid to watch Netflix.
You know, and then we live in a world where parties are a real thing, where people just voluntarily give whatever they have to everybody.
That's true.
I mean, you know, like, what a cheaper, like, solution would be is just to, like, give these people sick leave and allow them to take PTO or, you know, paid sick days off so that they, when they know that they're sick, that they just don't come in. And well, then you don't have to design a machine that determines that people are sick.
Bryce, the problem is in that system, which as exists and in many places is there, is that somebody says, great, I will take my X number of sick days, and then I go get sick after that. They don't wait until they're sick to take the sick days. You just take the sick days, and then what happens when you've taken your sick days and you get ill? You show up, which is what most people actually do in many situations. So it gets into the problem of, like, so what happens in that situation where I already used my sick days for the year and I have the flu and I use them, maybe I was ill, whatever, but I show up at work to work the line at McDonald's and I've got the latest nasty version of the flu. What happens?
Sure. I mean, and I mean, it could be the same thing where if you use all your sick days and you were sick, and yeah, I mean, yeah, I mean, there, I'm not suggesting the be all end all, but,
I'm saying that like in a case where my situation is, if somebody shows up sick, like legit has sick, then yeah, you just pay them to go home. My solution is that, because otherwise they're incentivized. I know that people will try to screw the system over. Far fewer people will try to screw the system over by getting sick. Some will. More people, you know, and what we'll do in this system is that people self-reporting or deciding, and I have friends too, like, no, I'm fine. And they're like, I'm like, they're clearly, they're not, they're coughing and stuff. And they want to be fine. They don't want to be sick at this moment. And they decided that they're going to tell everybody that they're fine. And you watch them. No, I'm fine. It's just it was some dry air. It was just whatever. And that happens all the time. And so the idea is, you know, using science to figure out, like, hey, don't spit on my Whopper.
Using science to say don't spit on my Whopper is a good way for hold on, how can I segue this? If you would like to be able to for us to afford a Whopper, why don't you head on over to patreon.com/weirdthings. That's where you can support the show. Head on over to patreon.com/weirdthings. You'll get immediate access to our after things talk as long as the full show, but most importantly, you'll be keeping us loud, live, and independent. Thank you to everybody who is one of our beautiful patrons over at Patreon.
Gentlemen, now that we've solved disease, did you hear about some people, so this novel sort of cancer treatment where they're using some injections in light rays into the eyes and one of the side effects?
Light rays? Wait, you know what? I think we did. Are you talking about? Hold on, keep going.
Wait, I think we did talk about this.
Yeah, how
wild. I think we might have talked about
it. Are we talking about where there's actual photons being generated inside of people's eyes?
The Cherenkov effect?
Yeah, this is
effect?
One where people are getting night vision.
Wait,
oh,
night
wait,
vision.
What? No. What? We did not. We talked about the Cherenkov effect. No, please go.
So there's a cancer treatment that was apparently giving people night vision, enhancing their night vision.
Now, how would that be?
How much enhanced?
Brian's just like, how mild a form of cancer do I have?
I mean, we just talked about maybe I can go kiss my girlfriend who has cancer and catch it.
So using photodynamic therapy where light is used to destroy malignant cells, plus some other injections, one of the side effects they've had is people noticed they had increased night vision. And basically what they think this relates to is that there's a protein in the eye called rhodopsin, which is one of the things which it helps our photoreceptors pick up light. And it may like increase like the number or the kind of rhodopsin you have as far as picking this up. And so that was the, the idea that, cause it's like, you're crazy. You think you have night vision. And they're like, whoa, wait, nope. This may actually increase night vision. So.
So how much are people are self-reporting that they are having better night vision? How much better night vision are we talking about? Is there any what is the vision? I'm sure there's no unit for describing how good you can see at any given point. But
So apparently it was the
how
the injection-
many predators is it measured in?
That's thermal too, though. as chlorine E6 absorbs the infrared radiation, it interacts with oxygen in the eye tissue, transform it into highly reactive singlet oxygen, as well as destroying cancer cells. Singlet oxygen can also react with retinol and enable boosted night vision, the molecular simulation shows. So basically it was the chlorine E6, which was acting as this kind of like little kind of enhancer, this sort of like this stimulant sort of thing that's like increases the, the sensitivity there.
Huh. And is it a permanent increase or just a temporary during the treatment?
I don't know. We're here.
We could talk about that in the theoretical. Is that something you would go in once a month and get a treatment just to boost up and have better night vision in general?
It seems like a very particular, you would have to be a very particular person who is going out and doing stuff in at night, right? Doing stuff and going and doing low
vision. I would say if you're a trucker, then that'd be something that you would want to make sure to do. Or maybe somebody...
Trucker vampire.
Maybe somebody over a certain age whose night vision has been demonstrated to have degraded beyond a certain level.
I could see it's soldiers and stuff. For me, I don't know if I want night vision because like there's too much damn light during the day for me to sleep.
Well, that would be I wonder if it would make you more photosensitive to the daylight.
During the daylight.
Yeah.
Daywalker.
Well, and then plus also, like, let's say if the thing that you're solving is that you can't see very well at night, there's also sort of technological fixes, obviously the biggest of which is lights. We have things called lights.
Or literally night vision goggles, right?
But if, if you're indoor, you could turn on the lights. But outdoors, that'd be interesting. I wonder if that could be like a regional treatment for areas. Like, for example, west of Austin is a town called Dripping Springs that has an ordinance that no lights are allowed to shine upwards. All of them have to have an umbrella that reflects and points them down specifically to because they are aware that being on the fringes of Austin, you get better night viewing and they don't want to have all of the light pollution. Mm-hmm.
Oh, you know who maybe this would be helpful for? I don't remember the name of the disorder. I only remember this is bad. I only remember watching a horror movie about it and having a fun little featurette about actual people, but people who are photosensitive to sunlight, right? People who live in dark or at night.
They're allergic to the sun.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like that would actually be a group of people who might find significant use out of this.
I just wonder, like, there's not a lot in here. Like, are people like, but or is regular light annoying to them now? Is it like increased photosensitivity to the point that, like, you know, is that the trade off that you're like, it's too bright out right now. And, you know, you're like, I hate this. Mm-hmm. I don't like being a vampire.
So how far? I guess it seems like all three of us are fairly lukewarm on the idea of this as a voluntary procedure.
Yeah. Just like, I mean, because what you have to do is have a laser get shot into your eye.
I'm okay with that.
I would be very hesitant about it personally.
Yeah, I think it's one of the things where it's also sort of the problem with a lot of science reporting where somebody read the paper. Somebody wrote an article about the paper, then everybody else is basically abstracting from that article and without reading the original paper and to know more about it. It's hard. It's a really frustrating thing. A lot of science reporting is that you realize they did not read the original paper because it's hard. And if they could really, you know, extract useful information from that at a deep level, they're probably not a science writer.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about that well. You remember that well we talked about last week, the underground wooden structure, the oldest wooden structure.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I there was another thing where, and I think we both found these from Science Alert, Andrew, mm-hmm. where, like, we didn't really get a good understanding of what the actual wooden object was from either the Science Alert reporting or the news story that they reported it from or any of the other findings. It's really kind of a weird space for science news.
Yeah, it is. And it's probably, you know, we Brian's favorite example about Michael Crichton and Marie Gilman looking at the newspaper going like, man, this is poor. This section, they don't know what they're talking about. It's like, man, it's probably everything. So anyhow, we shall see. A little bit of a setback on space news, and that is that Boeing Starliner, which is the two craft which are designed to return Americans into space from American soil, which is the Boeing Starliner and the SpaceX Crew Dragon. Starliner had a launch. We're supposed to intercept the International Space Station. It didn't. That was sort of like a bonus sort of thing that it was supposed to do. It came back down, and there was a software issue on one aspect of it. And then they just realized there was another software issue on it too, or this got disclosed where they had to do an update on it, or it probably never would have landed in the first place. So there's been a couple major issues with that.
I think you're a couple of steps ahead of me. Step one thing I'm hearing for the first time, Starliner had, it was what, a test launch?
Yeah, we talked about this before on a prior episode where it was supposed to go catch up with the space station. And it didn't. It was supposed to do their test launch was it was supposed to go up, go into orbit and go intercept the space station. And that there was some sort of there was a timing error between when the engines are supposed to fire. So it didn't. And so it came back down. They said, OK, we'll bring it back down to Earth. Right. So that was problem number one, which was disclosed like, you know, a month or so ago when that happened.
And come back down to Earth means let it just burn up in atmosphere.
No. Landed. It parachutes all that because this is designed to carry astronauts.
Got it.
They do the profile of like what would happen if there had been a mistake. You know, bring the people safely back down. So it did that part. It came back down, landed, everything was fine inside of there. And there was this question of like, well, will they be able to now just go straight to carrying astronauts, even though they had that little timing miscalculation? And, you know, because they're like, oh, well, other than that, everything's fine. Well, it turns out there was another mistake that took place, which was a software issue where apparently they had to load some sort of, they realized there was a problem. They had to update something mid-flight, which could have been a catastrophic error, meaning loss of vehicle, loss of crew, if there had been people on there. Mm. So that just got disclosed like a week or so ago or 2 weeks ago. And that's now going to maybe affect the timeline of when Starliner carries people into space, because NASA is probably going to ask Boeing now, like, no, we want another test launch. And so Boeing's already set aside, like, counted like a $400 million loss to sort of say, hey, we think we're going to have to do another, we may have to do another launch to satisfy NASA safety requirements. Mm. So it's frustrating, you know.
Do you think that they, what about it, just the fact that there was the failure and that there's a second launch, or do you believe that the second test launch is maybe superfluous?
Well, I think they need to do it. I think that there is the parts of Boeing that make airplanes and the parts that make rockets are completely separated, but there is this sort of fear, and that's the problem. They've been looking at what happened to the Boeing Max and the process by which things move. You know, they use sort of their version of the agile method or whatever, which works great in some things, but maybe not there. And there's sort of a fear that there may be a more pervasive flaw in some of the ways in which things are being moved through and saying to their readiness, I guess. And I think that's absolutely essential. I think they need to do another launch before they put astronauts on there, because they had the one mistake, the whoopsie, we can fix this. And now, like, oh, yeah, no, there was this other thing that went wrong. And prior, they had a parachute thing where one parachute didn't deploy. And it was like, oh, no, we can handle that. And it's like, there hasn't been a flawless launch yet. So it's disconcerting. SpaceX, you know, their Crew Dragons had, they were in through the same thing with Boeing, trying to get the parachutes to deploy right, all sorts of stuff there. They had, when SpaceX went to go test the Crew Dragon, as we talked about before, after it had gone up, came back down, they fueled it up and exploded on the test pad, which was not a happy outcome. You know, in their defense, it was like, well, this wouldn't have happened when there were astronauts in there, would have been after the fact, but still. Was not foreseen. They had their last launch when everything went great. And so now looks like May is when SpaceX may be launching astronauts on board the Crew Dragon.
So how, in terms of payload capacity, do you happen to know how close the Starliner is to the SpaceX one?
I think they're roughly equivalent, because I think they both can hold up to like 7 people as far as the tonnage.
They look similar is the reason I asked the question.
Yeah, I'm sure Bryce could probably get a more accurate answer than I can. You know, and it's a thing where, you know, I want both to work. We want both. You know, and SpaceX forums will get into this like, you know, this is a win for SpaceX. Like, no, it's not, guys. This just puts a lack of confidence, one, in, you know, manned spaceflight, et cetera. And, you know, we want to have multiple options, all of that. So I can't imagine, you know, what it's like to be a Boeing engineer, to be some of the best people in the world of what you do, and to have maybe just bad luck or just management along the way. Just, you know, so.
I mean, it's not like it's rocket science.
exactly.
The Starliner crew capsule can hold up to 7 people or a mix of crew and cargo, which I think is comparable to the Dragon capsule.
The Crew Dragon, I think so. Yeah.
And then meanwhile, separate story, over in Baikonur, Kazakhstan, the cost of a Russian space flight has quadrupled over the last 10 years. Is that right? Four really? Times as much.
Oof. Well, and you know, their defense,
I mean,
you know, they don't have a lot of customers. Yeah, and it's market prices, folks. You know, and then the reliability, you know, that's a proven system that we know a lot about. So
that is one of the other weird things. It's like I don't want to be the one to jinx it, but a 0% failure rate. That's extraordinary in a world where, you know,
asterisk.
I mean, again, I said I don't want to be the one to jinx it. And I guess also,
well, no, they lost one. The first test, they lost a cosmonaut. But yes,
correct. But I guess since we've been a customer, America's been showing up.
Yeah. That's the asterisk, is that the first guy to test thing got flattened. But yeah, it's you know, it's built in a lot of the best sort of Soviet ways, which is reliable, simple, excruciatingly painful to do. And I mentioned this before, like, but it's a funny story. Was like, when NASA or somebody, they were sending some satellites up on a Russian spacecraft. They said they got the tolerances, like it has to be able to handle X number of G forces, and it says has to be able to handle like 6 G's. And the engineers contacted the Russians like, your launch is only like 4 G's. This doesn't make any sense. They go, oh no, the 6 G's is because of the train ride out to our launch facility,
which
is the middle of nowhere. That's where it has the most damage if you put a satellite is on that train. Go,
oh wow.
Wow, that's crazy.
That's amazing. What do you pick?
I want to dial back my pick of Picard. Previously.
Wow.
There's been two fairly soft episodes of Picard.
And going into Picard,
I liked it a lot.
The first you really liked the first episode of Picard, and you didn't love the second episode, but our friend on Court Killers, Meryl Barr, said, "Hey, maybe remember to treat it as a package.
Yeah.
Sit through maybe some of the low parts to get back to the good stuff." But
Episode
3 is still not there?
No.
What's wrong with
the addition of Space Wolverine didn't help much. Like, let's just have a character that definitely looks like Logan with a piece of shrapnel out of him, and he's drinking whiskey and smoking a cigar, mm-hmm. and he's like, "I'm gonna be your pilot. It's the end of the third episode, and we're finally putting a crew together. Rrr, guess who I am, Professor X? I mean Picard." I didn't care. I'm not having a good time.
Wow, unfortunate.
Ugh.
Well, that's gonna be your anti pick.
Well, sorry. if I'm gonna pick,
did the whole thing. I in my notes, I went through the whole thing of like starting to put it down.
No, I don't know that I have much of a pro pick. You know what? Just put me down for a negative pick.
The anti-pick of Picard. I got a pick.
I wish the show all the well, but I have like kind of like Google alerts in my head when a show is announced, and certain things I hear, I go, oh, cool. Then I hear, I'm like, oh, and then certain words that are said, and I'm going, oh, and then the show comes out.
You know what? I will give a pro pick, and this is my second lap with What We Do in the Shadows that I'm watching with my daughter Josephine, who's 12 years old, and we definitely watched a whole episode about a vampire orgy, complete with the final scene where the door opens, and you see two vampires having passionate sex in the form of bats. it's so good.
Is season two out now?
I don't think
it is.
Wednesday, April 15th is when it comes out.
Oh, I see. Okay, very
close.
Cool.
Around the corner.
Almost.
Yeah.
Yeah, that show is great. I still haven't seen the movie. I still want to go see the movie. The original movie.
Movie is pretty much the show, right? It's just it'll be candy. In fact, I would say save that as a treat the same way I'm saving Hunt for the Wilder People, because I'm told that's very good, but I've never seen it. Mm. But and I assume since it's Taika Waititi, it'll be great. The same daughter who really is enjoying What We Do in the Shadows is begging me to take her to go see Jojo Rabbit. I don't know that emotionally I'm ready to go do that again.
I still haven't gone. Is it still in theaters? I didn't even realize
it is. It is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
There we go. We're in the shadows. I got a pick. Over the weekend, I got a chance to play a little video game, and it was one that I had been, I'd had on my radar for a long time, and never found the right chance to play it. But this weekend just ended up being right, and this is a game called Later Alligator, and it is it's not a point and click adventure game. It looks like one. But it is it's more like a mini game. And so the idea is you meet this alligator Pat. You're in Alligator, New York City, where everyone is alligators. And
do people live in the sewers?
No, they live above ground. And Pat,
we had a pet human for a while, but it started to grow up, so we flushed it down the toilet.
And so you meet Pat, who's like, "Oh, my family's in the mob, and they're gonna rub me out. They're gonna kill me. So I need you to go around the city and find out what they're gonna plan to do to me tonight. And also, it's my birthday, and you need to find out what the event is that they're doing for me tonight." And so you go around the city and you do mini games for people, and And then the story happens. It's a very small story. It's a very short story, and it's only like $18 on Steam right now. I saw the true ending, quote unquote true ending, in about 3 hours, if that gives you a sense of kind of how long it is. But it's really well written. The animation is really well done.
It looks great. I mean, it looks like an Adult Swim show, which I realize is damning with faint praise.
I would say, like, it was a little frustrating getting to the true ending, because there's a point where you're just like trying to kill time in the game, because it's like a turn-based time sort of system. But I think it's really nice, and really a really good small. It's a nice small experience. We're looking for a nice small game. Later, alligator.
I have a pick, and you know, we've talked a lot about Wuhan and viruses and stuff like this, and it can get scary, and I want to take everybody's minds off that with just some like pure entertainment. And so I recommend the Steven Soderbergh movie Contagion, which is
who's convinced
very,
there's
going to
be
well
outbreak.
Have you seen this monkey? Contagion, which Contagion came out a long time ago, 2011, ancient history. But what's fascinating about that is you had Twitter, and you had most of what we recognize as social media today. So even though a movie that's almost 10 years old, it's neat to watch something where Twitter, you know, people spreading rumors on Twitter and all that sort of a thing. And if you've never seen it, I highly recommend it. Even, and it's worth going back to see it, because Soderbergh wanted to do a very realistic depiction of what if an extremely virulent and deadly contagion, you know, thing had an outbreak. And get this, starts in Asia. It got praised for being pretty accurate. Its use of terminology. You're trying to show how things, you know, spread, how people try to solve the problem, the problems that are created. You know, Jude Law plays this wonderfully corrupt character who's this conspiracy theorist who's kind of pushing his own theories and stuff on it. It's just a great cast. And also what's amazing about it is, and probably to the strength of Soderbergh as a director, he was able to get people on board where, like, no spoiler, because it's like happened very first, is Gwyneth Paltrow is the like the original person who spreads it. You know, and, you know, Jude Law's character is basically kind of a bad guy. And to get, you know, leading actors to say, no, you're going to play kind of reprehensible people, or you're going to do things that are just not likable, is I respect those actors even more for doing that. Hmm. So, you know, it's got at least three people who've been in Marvel movies. So that's cool. You know, I do that. That's my Marvel movie index, is how many of these leads have like starred together in, you know, Marvel movies. It's a dumb thing I do in my head. It used to be like 7-6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. But anyhow, I think, have you guys seen it?
No, I don't think I ever did.
Oh, please do. If you get a chance. It's on Cinemax. So you can do like the Cinemax trial sort of thing to watch it. But it was funny to watch, like, on iTunes, you had, like, pop up, like, what was the most watched, like, the most watched movies or whatever, and Contagion popped up, because as Wuhan and all that started making news, people were like, well, I kind of want to watch something about this, so.
It looks like it might also be on Hulu. It may be on Hulu if you have Hulu.
Yeah, like, with an add-on.
Oh, yeah, you need Cinemax. No, you're right.
Okay. Yeah. Weird. But, so. Brian's that recommends The Stand. Stan McMahon, that description in the beginning of the book about the spread is great. It's creepy. Well, that was like my first entry level.
Am I right? I think we covered on Cord Killers that The Stand is going to be, I think, an Amazon original, a Prime. There's some talk about that. Or maybe it was The Dark Tower. I could have sworn there was some version of The Stand.
Made too. And every King property now is in play.
So. Yeah.
But yeah, Stand is being made too.
Apparently. So. Somebody cracked the code. It is possible to make a good Stephen King adaptation. Quick, everybody, do it again.
Well, it's the trick is doing it with things that weren't like the novellas. Because like Shawshank was a Stephen King. You know, Stand By Me was a, you know, Stephen King adaptation. You know, the trick was, you know, yeah, the longer ones. But you know what's funny is, like, do we talk about that going back and watching the miniseries version of The Stand?
I can't let myself do that.
You know, some things hold up really well.
But the walking dude as a dude in a perpetual Canadian tuxedo, you know, I don't know.
Oh. Some things do not hold up well, and that was an example of something I went back. When did that come out originally? I'm like, yeah, like 94. Early 1990s were a special time because things we thought like our standards were so low.
Yeah. Well, and I think it was 93 is when it was. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, there are some things you go back like, wow, this was way cheesier than I remember. Like I remember loving like the TV movie version of The Shining. And then I go watch this now. I'm like, holy crap. Like,
yeah. Well, Rob Lowe. Gary Sinise.
Yeah, fun times.
You know what? That's my recommendation.
Is the 1994? Not the new one coming to. Not the new one coming to All Access.
That's right.
Well, everybody, wash your hands. It's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.